Dear Sustainable Futures enthusiasts, my name is Alexandra Koutsoukos, and this is Sustainable Futures, the podcast, a live-work platform to string conversations at the crossover between sustainability, design, and personal experiences. Done with heart by live workers for live workers. In today's episode, I have a conversation with a guest familiar to many live workers. We'll talk about the common roots between climate change and racism, exploring the systems that describe and reinforce these mechanisms.
Hi, Luke.
Hello.
Today, at our podcast episode, we have as our guest Luke Roberts. Many at LiveWork already know Luke because he's been helping us with our conflict resolution through workshops and lectures. Do you maybe want to introduce yourself?
Sure, Alexandra. So I'm Dr. Luke Roberts. I have a background in conflict resolution, as you've just said, for about 20 years. But I also completed my PhD a couple of years ago, looking at complex systems and how do we sustain innovation in organizations and communities.
Super cool. Yeah, so you've been helping us a whole lot, finding out the ins and outs of how can we pivot our organization and how can we become better at dealing with our conflicts and, let's say, evolving in the way that we conduct the organization. However, today we're here to talk about something that is slightly different, but we had a really interesting conversation about this, and I thought it would be very nice to share this with the rest of LiveWork as well. So what we want to talk about today is inspired by the book by Amitav Ghosh. I don't know how it's pronounced, but it's The Nutmeg's Curse, Parables for a Planet in Crisis. And basically, the book argues that the dynamics of climate change are rooted in geopolitical orders constructed by colonialism. And this is the same root that causes racism, obviously. So there is a very strong connection between climate change and racism. And in the book, let's say the nutmeg is taken as a sort of like parable of how human history has always been related to natural, materials, to materials of the earth. So something that I would love to explore with you is, what is your understanding and how is your experience around how climate change and racism originate from the same root?
Ooh, there's a question, Alexander.
Going straight to the point.
I think, so if we think about it from this perspective, that there's the exploitation of resources. And so whether that's human resources or natural resources, colonialism had to have a way of extracting those resources. And to do that, you have to also dehumanize the people who are presently in control or claim to have ownership of those resources. So the mythology around colonialism was to say that these are uncivilized people. These are people that, aren't as sophisticated as us. So they're not able to have the ability to genuinely control their resources. So firstly, we put them in an infantile state. They're too childish to understand. And then you can build other narratives around that as well, because they're infantile, they're less sophisticated, they're less cultured. So therefore it becomes easier to create higher levels of harm towards people. And so I think the combination of both kind of the exploitation of natural resources and human resources throughout history through colonialism shows that how intertwined the two are, because even now, you have the exploitation of natural resources in Africa, for example, and these are some of the lowest paid people collecting kind of resources for mobile phones, for jewelry. That exploitation of the land by those people who don't profit in any way, or they profit at such a marginal rate to just exist rather than live, is one of the legacies of this combination of both the exploitation of natural and human resources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's the same mindset at the end of the day. The fact that you can, like, there's a underlying Western culture that is deeply rooted in us, that is that of extractivism. You know, like the fact that you can exploit resources, that Earth is infinite, and that extracting, you know, without giving back and without considering living forms that we that mythologically are outside of us, as you said, it's okay, which is not, obviously. So it's a sort of like result of a mechanistic view of Earth, of the fact that it can just give and give and give without, and we can take without necessarily having to give anything back. And this, as you mentioned, also projected onto cultures and people that had a different, even look from us, which is, it's a very superficial way of looking at things, if you ask me.
It is. And I think there was a book by the Club of Rome, which is called The Limits of Growth, and they took a systems thinking approach. And I think this is where you start to see a kind of a mental shift, if you like, from that mechanistic worldview towards a systems worldview. So if you take somewhere like the Amazon, you know, when people first arrived, it must have looked like it was a resource that could go on forever. But two things happen at the same time. So firstly, the exploitation of the Amazon itself starts to have its own limits in terms of how much can we destroy before it hits a tipping point where it will then, you'll lose the biodiversity. But also for those people who are the indigenous population, the tribal population, their cultures are being absolutely wiped out. And so the paradox is they have to use the legal systems that have potentially enabled those people to exploit their land to then defend themselves against it, which means you have to adapt to a new system that has already put you in a position of weakness through lack of knowledge about itself and its history as well. So there is this constant challenge when we think about this idea of discrimination and subjugation, is that often those people who have the power to exploit through that mechanistic mindset then also have system dominance in other places, such as the legal and the political. So it amplifies itself in the system.
Yeah, something that I was thinking about when maybe it's a bit of a tangent, still reflecting on the different nature between how Western white cultures deal with this very linear cause and effect, you know, like the whole principle of capitalism that is a bit like, I take resources, I make it into something, and that gives me some sort of profit. And instead, like the way indigenous cultures have this more systemic, you know, way of looking at, benefits, you know, like a more distributed view. Also, not for populations now, not for nature now, but also for the future. So it feels like we kind of like lost the forward looking, that type of, like this cathedral thinking, you know, there used to be this idea that building cathedrals and investing in building cathedrals was not something that would make people who would live in the time when the cathedrals were built benefit from it, but it was something that was going to be for their children and their grandchildren. So this idea of like being good ancestors.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's where kind of like the issue of capitalism, exploitation and profit is all about success in the now. So when you look at companies that are amassing huge amounts of wealth, well, what does that wealth mean in 10, 50, 20, you know, 100 years time kind of thing? So yes, the company may survive, but what's the environment that it has to survive in? And I think linking that back to the idea of this interplay between racism and climate change, one of the things that's clearly going to happen is that the people who are least likely to contribute to climate change are the ones that are going to suffer the most. And so then you get this kind of issue where not only are the people of color in the, you know, like small island states already, you know, asking for money to create climate defenses and not getting it by rich nations. But also what will happen is as those countries have become unlivable in the future, you will then get this consequence of immigration. Mm-hmm. And so richer nation states will then be racist towards, you know, climate migrants, because they don't want them there unless they can exploit them in some way again. So it feels very, how can I put it, grubby and insidious, the way in which the system is behaving at the moment. But this interplay with race and climate change is linked to colonialism. Mm. And I think I'd go one step further, and there's a colonialism of the mind, if you like, that if people tend to think that, you know, we can exploit concepts and exploit ideas just to further these agendas, it means you help perpetuate the climate crisis.
Yeah, yes, I think you've explained it super, super well. And something that, you know, also reflecting on our position as designers, I feel like sometimes we reinforce that type of like colonialist mindset. So, for example, when we do research, I have the feeling very often that we do it in a very extractive way without necessarily like finding ways of doing participatory research in a way where you also participate and you're like, you put yourself on the line as well and you also give back. So I don't know, often enough, you know, you doing research for us is about doing interviews and asking people their needs and exploring their emotions. And yes, it's all very human-centered, fantastic. But then what do you give them back? You know, at the end, you kind of like take this thing and you transform it into a thing that you sell back to them. So to me, still that, like, I don't know, it hurts me. You know, so I wonder, how can we as designers also get out of that paradigm? And, you know, I think, as designers, as creators, however you want to put it, we have to be very mindful about how we reinforce this system or this paradigm, or how we can break off of it. And I think one of the things that, let's say, helps me is stopping to think as a designer and starting to think as a human more, and starting to think as a person. So this whole idea of being objective in research is, I think, is at this point outdated, because like you either recognize all of the biases that us as beholders of our own heritage, you know, have, or don't pretend to be unbiased, because you for sure are. So how can you, like, I don't know, maybe this is an invitation, and it's really difficult, but for example, in school, we're taught to be very objective and try to extract insights from research in the most objective way, but we do put our own filter to it. So it's like, if you don't do as a designer, as a creator, as a creative, I don't know, however you want to call it, as a person that puts things in the world, if you don't acknowledge that lens that you look the world through, then it's, you reinforce the system.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, again, this goes back to, well, what's the paradigm you sit within? So if you are sitting within a positivist, which is I look for evidence and the world is objective, paradigm and way of knowing, then you don't have to position yourself at all. And so that means that, you know, when you think about like medical trials, for example, we're just trying to find cause and effects with, I don't know, a vaccine, for example. So why does the researcher need to recognize their own positionality in that type of research? Well, this is where then you get exactly your point, discrimination against women, against people of color, because my position is, you know, as a researcher, might be that of the white male. Mm-hmm. And so therefore I am invisible to my own position within my research. And I think this is something that, this objectivity is something that is really powerful in disguising power. And so whether you're a designer, or for myself, as someone who thinks in systems, I would argue that I am always in the system. And so I don't pretend that when I'm either working with clients or doing research that I am objective. I am now part of that system because I've chosen to interact, and that system may try to engage me in various types of relationships. So I have to be incredibly mindful of both my positionality, but also the power that may come with that positionality. So I think there is something about making that visible that becomes really important, rather than going through the pretense that you're not and then being caught by surprise by either your own biases or the biases that are laden within the methodology you're using. I think there's a second thing in there which really struck me, which was in my own research, I was constantly challenged to say, well, what are you going to give back to the communities that you've worked with in your research? So I'd like actually go back and go, here's what I found about your locality, and here's the insights I've got, and then we can have a discussion about that. So I think there is a real danger, just like going right back to this thing about the exploitation of natural and human resources, there's a real danger, the exploitation of consciousness and, you know, narrative. And so again, it's about making sure that we don't fall in to these traps that are there that then help perpetuate other forms of exploitation, which then marginalize those people who are already experiencing hardship. Often those people of color are invisible, and so therefore it becomes really hard to hear their voice in unless it's been, you know, translated through that of the designer, of the researcher, rather than, well, what is it that they would want to know, they would want to say, and the outcomes they would like to see, and how do we incorporate that into our design or into our thinking? And I think within that, Alexandra, I'd have to say, like, this is where you have to be careful around things like persona, because there is a power position in the persona service designers create, and that can then be perpetuated, can perpetuate the biases of the client, of the community. So let's not pretend that there isn't decisions being made, that, you know, you are always giving someone agency when you're service designing. The question is, who is the more interesting one for me, and who gets to benefit from that?
Yeah, that's brilliant. Thank you so much. It was a really nice conversation, and there are so many more hints, you know, cues for more. So thank you so much.
You too. Absolute pleasure. Take care.